Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former CIA analyst David McMichael, who examines plans now actively being considered by President Bush to increase the level of U.S. troops in Iraq by as many as 30,000. Ni Akoete of Africa Action, who describes the urgent need for the international community to exert pressure on the government of Sudan to allow the deployment of a UN protection force in the war-torn Darfur region. And Jean Bruskin, an organizer with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, who discusses the intense union drive now going on at the largest hog slaughterhouse in the world, run by Smithfield Farms in Tar Heel, North Carolina. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
2 years after the massive South Asian tsunami that killed 230,000 people in a dozen nations, survivors still live in temporary housing and face possible eviction. In Sri Lanka, 100 families were recently evicted from a refugee camp because their landlord wanted to build on the property. Most people displaced by the tsunami do not have deeds for the land they lived on before the storm, and Sri Lanka has refused to build permanent housing for those without property records. The displaced people must now rely on aid from community groups. In Aceh, Indonesia, the area hardest hit by the tsunami, Oxfam International reports 25,000 landless families are waiting for housing and have been largely ignored in the current rebuilding effort. Oxfam states that the fight for land rights have been hampered by the wholesale destruction of records during the flooding from the tsunami in Aceh. Many people also lost identification papers, and 15% of the region's productive agricultural land was destroyed by the killer storm. Meanwhile, the resorts along the southern coast of Thailand have been rebuilt, and the beaches are once again packed with tourists. Iran's hardline president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, suffered a surprising defeat in local elections and in the race for the powerful assembly of experts which oversees Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The big winner was former President Akbar Hashimi Rafsanjani, who lost to the little-known Ahmadinejad in the 2005 presidential election. Rafsanjani was the top vote-getter for the Tehran seat on the Assembly of Experts. He is also leader of the Pragmatic Conservative bloc. Reformers also made a comeback in local elections by picking up seats in Tehran and other major cities. The pro-reform Islamic Iran Participation Front hailed the downfall of Ahmadinejad hardliners who won few council seats. In a statement, the front declared, "These results are tantamount to a big no to the government's authoritarian and inefficient methods." The municipal election, with a 60% turnout, came only days after Ahmadinejad hosted a conference of Holocaust deniers that was condemned by world leaders. In the past, Rafsanjani has called for more engagement with the European Union in negotiation over Iran's nuclear program rather than the current policy of defiance. Yet, few Persian watchers expect Ahmadinejad to change his hardline policies. With housing prices falling and mortgage rates inching upwards, a new wave of consumer bankruptcies is expected to emerge in 2007. But strapped homeowners will face a tough 2005 federal bankruptcy law that makes it harder to file for Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which creates a clean slate for all debts. Instead, they will have to file for Chapter 13 protection, forcing them to repay a portion of their old debts. The new law was pushed through Congress by a coalition of banks, retailers, and credit card companies. According to the Orlando Sentinel newspaper, in the recent housing boom, a growing number of homeowners bought speculative interest-only mortgages. As interest rates rise, their monthly mortgage payments could double. Florida bankruptcy lawyer Jules Cohen expects to see many distressed homeowners get 2 or 3 months behind and file Chapter 13 bankruptcy in the hope they can prevent foreclosure. Since the 2005 bankruptcy law overhaul, the number of people filing for Chapter 7 bankruptcy has fallen sharply, and some lawyers have stopped representing consumer bankruptcy clients. Suburban Virginia attorney Lawrence Brook asserted, The law is designed to make life miserable for anybody who owes money. It's a help to the banks squishing the little guy. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
In a post-election search for a new direction in his Iraq policy, President Bush not too subtly dismissed recommendations made by the Iraq Study Group, led by former Republican Secretary of State James Baker, which had proposed a drawdown of American soldiers in Iraq beginning early in 2007. Now Mr. Bush is considering a temporary increase in the level of U.S. troops there by as many as 30,000. The White House is expected to announce a new strategy for Iraq early in the new year. Conflicting news reports paint a picture of division among top brass at the Pentagon over the so-called surge plan. The proposal to escalate the Iraq war, detailed in a paper titled Choosing Victory, A Plan for Success in Iraq, was authored by Frederick W. Kagan, a resident neoconservative scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. While members of the Bush administration are reportedly closing ranks in support of the plan to pour new U.S. troops into Iraq, recent public opinion polls show an overwhelming majority of Americans oppose escalation of the war. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with former CIA analyst David McMichael, who examines the surge plan and the likely response from Democrats who take control of Congress in January.
If you put 30,000 additional troops, a surge, into Iraq, what are they supposed to do? What is their tactical military objective? This is not like a war between armies in which you say, okay, we're going to go in and conquer Anbar province or something, because we've conquered it several times and still lose troops there every day. It's a question of, will they merely provide more targets for the insurgents with their improvised explosive devices and snipers? And what do they hope to accomplish? And that is, a very serious question. And to date, no one has been able to come up with any convincing answer on that.
What is your view of the role of the military versus the political solution that even the military seems to feel is the only way out?
People can talk about a diplomatic solution all they wish, but unless the solution, the diplomatic, the diplomacy is to lead to some sort of a withdrawal of the United States forces, which I think unarguably are the primary cause of the ongoing violence. They are the target, if you will. The sectarian violence, of course, goes on the side by side with it, but what authorizes the sectarian violence, really, is the presence of an occupying army. So the question is, how do you get, if you're really interested in a peaceful solution there, what you're negotiating about is the withdrawal of United States forces. Now, what the administration is talking about is the need to, quote-unquote, achieve victory, by which they mean some military victory in Iraq. Now, I don't think these things are mutually supportive. There has to be one or the other. So this question of the surge in there, seems to me, rather like if we go back to the Vietnam example, to the following the Tet period and the demand of the then U.S. Commander in Vietnam of another huge surge in American forces there, which was regarded as unsupportable, and thus led to the drawdown, the final removal of United States forces from Vietnam. Something like that is eventually going to happen in Iraq. But for the time being, they say this call for dispatching of, at a minimum, another 30,000 troops into Iraq with, as the military point out, and Bush himself admits, without any clearly defined tactical immediate objective for their use, tends to look, at least to me, like, don't just stand there, do something. And that's not a way to plan either militarily or diplomatically.
David, as we conclude, I wanted to ask you what your hopes and fears are from this new U.S. Congress. The Democrats are taking power in the House of Representatives for the first time since 1994, and they will have the power of the purse, but yet we hear that Speaker of the House, Democrat Nancy Pelosi, is saying that won't be their course of action, that they will not put pressure on the budget of the military in order to stop this war in Iraq. What do you think is going to happen in the Congress? Do you think the Democrats have more resolve than what we've heard so far from Nancy Pelosi?
I would hope so, and I'm rather encouraged, by the way, to note that both the Republican senator from Minnesota, Norman Coleman, and the Democratic senator-elect, Amy Klobuchar, are saying that they are not going to support more budget for the war in Iraq, and the Republican senator from Oregon, Gordon Edwards, has declared openly he regards this war now as, quote-unquote, a crime and will no longer vote for it. Dennis Kucinich has already launched another presidential bid by arguing precisely for the use of the power of the purse and to cut this off. So arguably, you're right in saying that it doesn't look as if the new Democratic Congress will take a firm stand on this. And it may be because they prefer, on a rather cynical political tactic of letting the Republican administration twist in the wind, so to speak, of a continuing disaster in Iraq for the next 2 years, and this will help them in the elections of 2008. So I'm genuinely afraid that this is the way the Pelosi and the Senate leader, Harry Reid, Democratic Party will approach this thing.
That was former CIA analyst David McMichael. He serves on the steering group of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Read McMichael's articles online at www.counterpunch.org. Despite the presence of a small African Union peacekeeping force numbering about 7,000, fighting continues in the Darfur region of western Sudan, where rebel groups seeking autonomy are battling government-backed Arab Janjaweed militias. Now the war has spilled over into the neighboring country of Chad, where the United Nations reports that more than 70 villages have been attacked, burned, or emptied since early November, causing a growing refugee problem there. With civilians often the target, the deadly conflict in Darfur has cost the lives of more than 200,000 and displaced over 2 million people. U.S. officials have characterized the attacks there as genocide. Recently, Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir said he accepts a U.N. package to help end escalating violence in Darfur and is ready to discuss a ceasefire. But the Sudanese head of state has rejected a Security Council resolution adopted in August that called for more than 20,000 UN peacekeepers to replace the African Union force. Hope remains that Sudan may be willing to accept a so-called hybrid protective force made up of both AU and UN troops. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ni Akowete, Executive Director of Africa Action, who describes the urgent need for the international community and the Bush administration to exert pressure on the government of Sudan to allow the deployment of a UN protective force in Darfur.
Currently, what has happened is that, you know, in May of 2006, participants in the conflict, that is one of the rebel movements in the government in Sudan, signed a peace agreement. And the peace agreement has not been implemented, and the group that did not sign kept on fighting, and the government is fighting them. And as we know, in fact, the core problem in Darfur is that the government, rather than sending uniformed troops to fight the rebels, gives government money and aid and support and directions to brutal ethnic militias known as Janjaweed, which target innocent people and villages. And that is what has led to the tragedy where as many as 2.5 million people have been choked out of their homes, have been forced to move, have been displaced. And the estimates of people killed is as low as 200,000 and as high as 400,000. Now, right now, the fighting is escalating because the rebel groups that did not sign the peace agreement because they thought the agreement was fraudulent and unworkable and gave the government too much leverage and control, they have actually metamorphosed into several militias, and they are fighting the government. And the government has lost some key battles, but in return, the government is escalating the fight, attacking major cities. In fact, so the violence is increasing. That is what is happening on the ground in Darfur. In Chad, the fighting has spilled over, although I have to really stress that Chad itself has its own internally rooted instability and violence issues. So the key is to stop the violence and protect civilians. And that means sending in robust troops that will stare down all of the militias, especially the government-sponsored Janjaweed militias, which are actually targeting villages and groups on ethnic basis. But the government of Sudan has refused to allow in a robust UN force. We think the key lies with, especially with two countries, the United States. The U.S., if it chooses to put sufficient pressure on the government of Sudan, will get the government of Sudan to cave in. There are many pressure points that the White House and the administration and even Congress can bring to bear on Sudan, and we think Sudan will give in. But unfortunately, the U.S., in our view, has not applied enough pressure, and we think they haven't done that because they are putting other issues over and above Darfur. But the other country we must not let off the hook is China. China gets a lot of oil from Sudan. It has deepening trading ties with not just Sudan, but with other African countries. Because of that, China has a lot of influence. We would like China to exert much more pressure on Sudan.
Your organization has written about the conflict that the Bush administration has in that they have some anti-terrorism agreements with the government of Sudan, and therefore it seems they're not willing to risk too much pressure on Sudan and jeopardize those cooperative agreements with the government of Sudan. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think you're absolutely right, Scott. I mean, one concrete example of this is that there is a gentleman, Sudanese gentleman called Abdallah Gosh, who is the head of the military intelligence. There is credible information that the United States invited this gentleman to Washington, to Langley Park, to meet with the CIA to share information on, quote, terrorists, whereas most people agree that this man is, you know, knee-deep in the blood of people in Darfur. He is complicit in the genocide in Darfur. So that is a very good example that the Bush administration believes that its global war on terrorism is of more importance than saving lives in Darfur. And we think quite the opposite. We think that if the U.S. does what is necessary, pressures Sudan, we get a protection force into Darfur, and the Darfur problem begins to be resolved, it will do wonders for the American image. It will win them a lot of goodwill. It will be extremely helpful. So this idea that you can cooperate with such people in Sudan in trying to deal with the global war on terrorism is very mistaken.
You know, it wasn't all that long ago that we witnessed the horrendous genocide of the Tutsi in Rwanda. But why do you think it's taken now 3 years to come up to speed here and really react in a forceful way to yet another genocide in Darfur?
You know, that is really a painful question and difficult to answer. Some people think that, you know, issues that happen in Africa get less coverage than issues that happen in Europe. I would like to think that they are not right and that it is not purely a racial question, but it makes you wonder. Now, I'll take at Africa Action. We believe that, you know, in this country, if you look at the history of the country, so many good things have happened because activists got up, galvanized support, created a critical mass, and forced the government of the United States to act right, to do the right thing. A small minority of committed people can always get enough people to force the government to do the right thing. That is a wonderful tradition in this country. That's the tradition we want to use.
That was Ni Akoete, Executive Director of Africa Action. To obtain a copy of the group's report, Leveraging New International Action on Darfur, call area code 202-546-7961 or visit their website at www.africaaction.org. The recent raid by U.S. Immigration Enforcement agents on 6 meatpacking plants around the country points to the importance of Latino immigrants, including undocumented immigrants, in what has become a largely non-union workforce. A century ago, Jewish, Polish, and other European immigrants worked in the packing plants of the Midwest, along with African Americans who had recently emigrated from the South seeking better opportunities. They helped unionize the thousands of workers in those plants. But times have changed and much of the workforce is non-union once again. The United Food and Commercial Workers, or UFCW, is now organizing the mostly African American and Latino immigrant workforce at the largest hog slaughterhouse in the world, run by Smithfield Farms in Tar Heel, North Carolina. The union condemns what it describes as the poverty wages, brutal conditions, and crippling injuries which it says plagues the 5,500 workers who are employed at the plant. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Gene Bruskin, director of the UFCW organizing campaign, who discusses the intense union drive now going on at the Smithfield plant and provides an overview of labor history in this sector of the workforce.
The Packing House Workers Union actually, way back in the 30s, was fighting against racism, was fighting against for equal pay for women before pay equity was even an issue. By the 80s, the companies started to take it back. And so the peak of wages and benefits for the packing industry was actually back in the early 1980s.
What were the factors that allowed the meatpacking industry to be so successful at busting the union over time?
Well, you know, I think it was connected to all of the industrial trends at that point. But in particular, it was the consolidation of the industry, you know, where they went from smaller companies into increasingly larger companies, and then larger non-union companies buying larger union companies and so on. And at the same time, the attitude of the employers that, you know, developed so well under Reagan that all bets were off. And so there were consistent attacks on unionization and on the contracts.
Lots of people have read the expose Fast Food Nation, and the fictionalized version recently came out as a movie. The conditions it depicted were pretty horrible, like a slimy combination of blood and guts on the kill floor. Is that realistic?
Yeah, that kind of stuff is really common. Particularly, you're killing these pigs and the blood is squirting out all over the place. Then there's water spraying everything and so on. And it's very easy for little pieces of meat to fall on the ground. And so you have a wet floor with a piece of wet meat on the ground and you step on that wet meat and it's like a skateboard. Injuries are rampant, and many of them are extremely serious, and the company routinely denies that these injuries happened on the job and fights you when you try to get workers' compensation. And then you can easily get fired in that process. So here you are, 25 years old. You've had a really serious shoulder injury. You try to get workers' compensation, you get fired. You can't go to the hospital because you no longer have medical insurance. you can't get another job because you have a permanent physical disability, and so you're totally screwed. There's thousands of people like that in this rural area because the company employs 5,500 workers and the turnover is close to 50%. So that means a couple thousand workers every year go through that plant. So over a five-year period, you're talking more than 10,000 people that have circled through, many of them injured. So this is like the land of the walking wounded down there, where people have been crushed and chewed up like fodder and thrown out the door by this company that is making a fortune.
So give us an update on the organizing effort at Smithfield.
The workers tried on more than one occasion to organize a union. And what the company did when the workers tried to have an election was they brought in the county sheriffs. They surrounded the voting booth with armed sheriffs, the voting area. They beat up the organizers and the committee in front of the National Labor Relations Board. They fired people. They threatened them. They arrested them. And then they appealed the Labor Board's findings that upheld this for almost 10 years in court. And every single finding was upheld, even under the Bush Labor Board. And so now the company's run out of appeals, and the union believes that there can be no fair election at Smithfield, that they have so poisoned the waters for so long that simply turning around and smiling and saying, we'll be good now, holds no credibility.
So what do the workers want?
What they really want is that the company sits down with the union and the workers from the plant and works out a fair process without any intimidation where the workers can simply sign cards, and if the majority of the workers want the union, they get it. And if they don't, they don't.
That was Gene Breskin, director of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Drive at the world's largest hog slaughterhouse. For more information on the Smithfield campaign, call the UFCW at area code 202-223-3311 or visit the union's website at www.smithfieldjustice.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Production. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Chris Berrio, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Curry.